Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, August 22, 2019. The Democratic National Committee is having a three-day conference right here in San Francisco, the beautiful city by the bay. And one of the discussions, which has turned into a debate, is whether the DNC should permit a single-topic debate for the presidential candidates on climate change. And as I've reported, this has been an issue that Tom Perez has been battling for a while. And in my conversation with Andrew Bacevich about a month ago, he had not heard that the DNC was actively working against this idea and had even warned Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, who dropped out of the presidential race yesterday after making a centerpiece of climate change issues. They had told Inslee that if he agreed to an unsanctioned debate on climate change, that he wouldn't be invited to the sanctioned debates. Well, Tom Perez, who's Barack Obama's hand-picked DNC chair, who was used to elbow out of the way the more progressive Keith Ellison after the stunning loss in 2016, well, he is insisting that it's a bad idea to set a precedent to have a single-topic debate, because then people want to debate about racial issues or about gun control or other topics. And the case is strongly made that climate change involves more than a single topic. And Exhibit A today is the stunning situation in the Amazon, where there has been a rapid acceleration in deforestation, and we cannot tell if the fires are being set in order to clear land or if this is part of the legacy of the continuing drought in the Amazon region. But Trump's buddy, Jair Bolsonaro, the strongman president of Brazil, is blaming environmentalists for setting fires to call attention against his government. He said the fire was started, it seemed, in strategic locations. There are images of the entire Amazon. How can that be? Everything indicates that people went there to film and then to set fires. Okay. So in July alone, 870 square miles of forest were lost. In the Amazon region, which is described as the lungs of the planet because the forests there sequester more carbon dioxide than perhaps any other region on Earth. And the area in the Amazon raised by fire has more than doubled in 2 years, from about 3,000 square miles during the first part of 2017 to 7,100 square miles during the same period this year. Back to San Francisco. Many of the presidential candidates will be here. We're told that Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden have other plans. And by the way, yesterday I mentioned the wrong Steyer. I was talking about Tom Steyer, but I called him Jim. Jim is his brother who runs a media watchdog group here in San Francisco, and I apologize for mixing them up. Tom Steyer will, of course, be on the scene in his hometown, trying to build support to get himself into the next round of debates coming up in September. And so seeing the leadership dither as the Amazon burns, Bernie Sanders wants people to feel a different kind of burn. He is holding an event in Paradise, California, in the charred ruins of a town that was virtually destroyed by a wildfire caused by a PG&E power line that was over 95 years old. And he's going to lay out an ambitious 10-year, $16 trillion mobilization related to climate catastrophe, warning that America risks losing $34 trillion in economic productivity by the end of the century if we don't respond appropriately. Now, I don't have much quibble with his plan. It is very aggressive. He wants to eliminate U.S. carbon emissions by 2050, and he is, let's see what else I have, other details here. He says the $16 trillion will be paid for over 15 years By making the fossil fuel industry pay for their pollution through litigation, fees, and taxes, and eliminating federal fossil fuel subsidies, he wants to cut emissions made in the U.S. as well as some produced in developing countries. He said he would reduce domestic emissions by at least 71% by 2030. He also wants to create 20 million new jobs in the process, and this is a kind of an expansion of the Green New Deal. And there are other plans out there. I want to acknowledge that Elizabeth Warren has offered a lot of solid policy proposals, although I feel that her climate plan is not one of those. The idea that the Pentagon is part of the solution, well, I have a hard time swallowing that. And we know that Joe Biden has a real kind of middle-of-the-road climate change plan. And I'm sorry that Jay Inslee dropped out so early. I thought that he did make some good points and has a strong record from Washington State to run on. But he decided it was safer for him to seek a third term as governor there, and he made that announcement today. Now, the New York Times went all the way to Iowa to discover an enthusiasm gap in the poll numbers of one Joe Biden, the former vice president who enjoys high name ID, and many people who believe that he can beat Trump more soundly than others. And some of the polling supports that, some of it doesn't. I believe that he largely benefits from his association with Obama, and that people have not examined his record carefully. They hear the argument that he is more electable, and I think because he is more conservative, or in their views, perhaps more moderate, many people just think that that is the safe way to go. But a pollster who is at Patrick Murray from the Monmouth Polling Institute, quote, "I did not meet one Biden voter in Iowa who is in any way, shape, or form excited about voting for Biden. They feel they have to vote for Joe Biden as the centrist candidate to keep somebody from the left who they feel is unelectable from getting the nomination." So the challenge becomes persuading Biden supporters that he is a weak candidate. In my view, he would replay the mistakes of John Kerry in 2004 and Hillary Clinton in 2016. And over the weekend, I was duking it out on Facebook with a bunch of Biden supporters led by my old pal Rich Robinson. Rich and I have worked on some local political campaigns together, and he's got a great record. He worked for Senator Alan Cranston. He worked on many Democratic campaigns in California. But he supported Joe Biden back in 1988, and he is still loyal to the Delaware Democrat. And he posted, "If we are to prevail as a nation, we cannot govern from the left, as Trump has governed on the right. My way or the highway, self-righteous dictatorships will never succeed long term. That's why I'm for Biden." Now, this demonization of the Democratic left by the Democratic center is the kind of circular firing squad that they talk about when it risks the fortunes of centrist candidates. So I responded, "Rich, my friend, we agree that Trump's the problem, but if you think Biden is the solution, your loyalty to Joe is clouding your usually sharp political instincts." He responded, "People know Biden. If our candidates win the nomination, I'll be happy to support them. Both Liz and Bernie have no ability to get their agenda passed." Well, that's down the road. First, you got to beat Trump. And the agenda, the proposals, the policy plans, those are ideas that are aspirational. They're the goals that people fight for. Nobody imagines that every proposal made by a winning presidential candidate will actually be implemented the way it was described during the campaign. But then I drew a comment from Nita Kat Aziz, who capitalized almost every word in her comment, just the first letter, not all caps. She wrote, "That is nothing more than that, a smear," she meant "than, because you're being dishonest to claim that the most experienced, ready for day one front-runner Biden who can win the electoral and popular vote is somehow not the solution to beat Trump." And then I responded to her particular comments, and I said, you need to step outside your bubble and try a little critical thinking. And I parroted her typing style. So then she hit back, you must be joking. Bubble? Critical thinking? Yes, it's you who didn't know what he was talking about. Do your homework, because our likely next President Biden has a great deal more going for him than the women of color supporting him. And she misconstrues, I didn't make any comments about women of color. Somebody else in the thread did. Then she goes on, Biden has a great deal going for him with outstanding accomplishments like writing the 1994 Clinton assault weapons ban, the Violence Against Women Act, overseeing Obama's $700-plus billion economic stimulus, spearheading the middle-class task force, he pushed through the Affordable Care Act, and too much more to mention. If you use that critical thinking you so arrogantly suggested that I do, then you wouldn't make misleading comments marginalizing Biden's support or worthiness for president. So I simply answered, Feinstein wrote the assault weapons ban, Biden wrote the crack penalties that harmed thousands of African Americans and only recently admitted his error. So it goes on. But what I came away with is that there are a lot of Biden or bust fans. There are people who believe that Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren would be dangerous for the Democrats to run. And they are completely wrong. Persuading them will be very difficult. And these are people who are still angry over Bernie Sanders' surge in the 2016 primaries. And they believe that the DNC did the right thing to use every available tool to block the insurgent Sanders campaign. That is the inside of the Democratic Party. And it's sad to see how they operate. If you recall, Adam Eichen is a young activist, a small D Democrat. He wrote a book with our friend Francis Moore LePay. And now he is part of Lawrence Lessig's election integrity unit based in the suburbs of Boston. And earlier this year, I interviewed Adam Eichen about his idea to use ranked choice voting in the overpopulated Democratic presidential primaries this year. And guess what? In Iowa, they're doing a bit of a test with ranked choice voting. They are going to, in February, let me see what the details are here. They're going to allow about 10% of the Democratic population to participate in a first-round selection of delegates who are aligned with specific candidates. They're going to be participating in virtual caucuses where they get to select their top five candidates. And this allows the assignment of second and third place votes. But there are rules here that could go wobbly. For example, the way it is structured is that you have to get 15% of the vote to be considered viable. And, for example, if only the top two get more than 15%, then it kind of defeats the purpose of ranked choice voting because the others will have their votes reassigned to one of the top two candidates. So it's not perfect, but I'm glad to see that it's being tested out in the campaign, in the primaries, where they mostly use the caucus process in Iowa. Today I'm releasing a new in-depth interview, just finished recording it a few minutes ago, with Trevor Aronson. I've had him on the program frequently because he is one of the few journalists dedicated to covering the FBI and its handling of so-called domestic terrorism cases. And I invited him today to expand on his August 8th article at The Intercept, where he explained why new laws against white supremacist violence, sometimes tagged as domestic terrorism, are the wrong response to El Paso, Dayton, and the other mass killings that have recently occurred.
Right. So since El Paso and frankly even a little bit before, but these calls came much louder after the El Paso shooting, there have been calls for new laws to help investigate and prosecute domestic terrorists, particularly white supremacists and white nationalists, whichever term you think is appropriate. And you know, the concern with that is that we've been here before, right? Like after 9/11, there was this kind of like oh dear moment where you know lawmakers and others said we don't have the laws on the books to you know, investigate Al-Qaeda and these international terrorists properly, and we need more authorities. We need the FBI to have more powers to investigate people, and we need laws that can better prosecute them and have more draconian sentencing. And so we had the Patriot Act, and the Patriot Act expanded many of these laws and created new ones. And in the nearly two decades since 9/11, what we've seen are you know, widespread abuses, particularly in Muslim communities, where the FBI is using sting operations and informants to find people allegedly connected to terrorism, but in many cases not really connected to terrorism, and using laws like material support that allow people to be prosecuted under anti-terrorism laws for doing rather simple things, driving someone to the airport, for example, or helping an informant that you believe is connected to Al-Qaeda but really isn't connected to Al-Qaeda, because in that way, conspiracy is enough for the conviction to withstand. And we've seen over and over these abuses, and you know, we've also seen these laws then applied to other groups. I mean, particularly environmental activists after 9/11. More recently, we've seen the FBI apply these to so-called black identity extremists or black activists associated with the Black Lives Matter movement. And you know, there is a pretty good history in the United States of, you know, in the rush and kind of post moment of danger, you know, enacting laws that we think are necessary to stop threats, but then those laws being further exploited by authorities and used against others.
That's Trevor Aronson of The Intercept. I invite you to listen to the full podcast released today to subscribers at iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, Stitcher, and at peterbcollins.com. And in addition to the cautionary note that Aronson sounds about new laws giving more police power, we also talk about the recent release of Hamid Hayat, who is one of the early so-called domestic terrorism convictions in the Lodi Mosque case. And the case has unraveled. He essentially has been found innocent, exonerated, and we talk about the implications of that in the current climate. And also the failure of Democrats to demand an analysis of the expansive law enforcement authorities that were implemented after 9/11 before they talk about adding new layers of law enforcement power. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. And today I want to shift a little bit. I'm not going to ask you to take out a subscription here. You've heard that appeal. I want to ask you to support Dana Jill Simpson. She is one of the whistleblowers who helped expose Karl Rove's railroading of former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman into federal prison behind bogus charges. Dana Jill Simpson now needs your help. She's fighting breast cancer. She lives kind of on the edge, riding around the country with her husband, who's a truck driver. And she's done a lot of great investigative reporting. And if you can help out, I've got a link in the show file for today's podcast to a GoFundMe page where you can kick in whatever is available to you. I'm going to make a donation of $100 today to support this cause. They're trying to raise $10,000 and only have about $900 so far. So if you have the means, I encourage you to act on that appeal at GoFundMe.com. And while we're talking about Alabama and exposing the wrongdoing of Karl Rove and his cronies, I want to mention Roger Shuler and his wife, Carol. They still can use your help as well. And you can find the PayPal button on Roger's blog post, which is legalschnauzer.blogspot.com. See, that's from memory. Now, across the country, more than 40 municipalities have been the victims of cyber attacks on their computers and servers. These are ransomware attacks. There is no indication that this comes from Russia or any effort to manipulate our elections. But I think it is a warning sign that all kinds of hackers attempt to hack into all kinds of websites every damn day. And the delusionary focus on Russian meddling in the 2016 campaign? Well, we see that of these 40 municipalities, one has paid $460,000 in Bitcoin to the invaders. That's Lake City, Florida. We're not sure about other cities who may have paid ransom but not admitted it publicly. The attacks are coming from Eastern Europe, Iran, and in some cases, get this, the United States of America. In Georgia alone, the city of Atlanta, the state's Department of Public Safety, state and local court systems, a major hospital, a county government, a police department for a city of 30,000 people. And if this does not point out the vulnerability of government websites and that we are just idiots if we conduct the 2020 presidential election on voting machines that can't be tallied, can't be audited, it is so simple. Hand-counted paper ballots, hand-counted at the polling place. That's how we get accurate data. And if the TV networks can't declare a winner on election night, so fucking what? The integrity of our elections is paramount. And we fail to address that at our own peril. Hey, get this. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is going to be paid even more than she was at the White House to lie for Trump. And you guess she's got a nice little catbird seat over there at the Fox News Channel. No indication. Oh, sometime in September, she will make her debut on the president's favorite show, Fox and Friends. The revolving door has spit her out and set her up for life. We're going to be hearing from Huckabee for a long time. Oh, and there's also controversy because Sean Boy Spicer has been accepted as a contestant on Dancing with the Stars, but the host of the show, I never watch it, I don't know who he is, he's complaining that he had been promised there wouldn't be any political controversies. Now, I have to admit that I've never heard of the Western Journal. Perhaps you haven't either. But it is an influential right-wing website. At one point, it had 36 million followers. According to a New York Times analysis, the Western Journal's Facebook post earned 750 million shares, likes, and comments, almost as many as the combined tally of 10 leading American news organizations. And it's a family-run operation from Texas, founded by the veteran conservative provocateur Floyd G. Brown and run by his younger son, Patrick. Now, they have been downgraded by Facebook and by Google after allegations of misleading headlines, sensationalized stories, and some business issues. And what we're hearing is that the Western Journal is getting the same treatment as left-leaning independent media sites that have been buried in the rabbit holes of Google search and consigned to algorithmic limitations on Facebook. We know it's hammered the Peter B. Collins podcast, Consortium News, Mint Press, Truth Dig, Truth Out. And now we learn that the right wing is complaining of some of the same issues. Last week, we learned that Patrick Byrne, the CEO of Overstock, has disclosed that he had a relationship with Maria Butina, who's been falsely called a Russian agent or a spy. And Patrick Byrne resigned as CEO of Overstock because his revelation hammered the company's stock. What he has disclosed is that he was a friend of Maria Butina. They met in Las Vegas in 2015, and their relationship became intimate at some point. Now, she has this cartoon boyfriend from Iowa. I can't summon his name right now. And who she sleeps with is not my business. But it appears that Patrick Byrne was the actual spy using sex to further his acquisition of information. He began communicating with the FBI about his interactions with Butina. And he said that his interactions with federal investigators were less about law enforcement and more about political espionage conducted against Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Now, I want you to listen here carefully. As James Bamford, in a podcast that we released on February 21st of this year, discredits the corporate media coverage of Maria Butina based on his own personal knowledge of about 3 years of Butina and her movements in Washington, D.C.
Well, they walked back basically everything. Yeah, they walked back the sex allegations, which were totally off the wall. They were basically, not basically, there were lies that the prosecution told in court. They walked back the whole idea of her getting her education as part of a cover, a Russian cover. They walked back the whole idea of her boyfriend as part of some sex plot to seduce him in order to get into the Republican Party and all that, or Republican politicians and so forth. So they walked back basically everything. All she ended up, they basically threw out those charges, and then all she pled to was a conspiracy charge, which was the lesser of the two charges. And she only did that after 4 months in solitary confinement.
That's James Bamford, the leading expert on the NSA and a longtime national intelligence journalist. And I've put up a link in the show file if you want to listen to that podcast from earlier this year, because the corporate media continues to falsely infer or flatly state that Maria Butina was a Russian spy, and there is no evidence to support that. I also want to recommend a long read over at the Gray Zone Project under the byline of a former diplomat from Ecuador. His name is Fidel Narvaez, and he worked at the Ecuadorian embassy in London for 6 of the 7 years that Julian Assange was holed up there. And he issues a 40-point rebuttal of the false reporting by CNN and the CNN Espanol channel, which you and I never watch, regarding the way that Assange was operating from the embassy in London. For example, rebuttal number one, quoting from CNN, new documents, this was in July, new documents obtained exclusively by CNN reveal that WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange received in-person deliveries, potentially of hacked materials related to the 2016 election, during a series of suspicious meetings at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And the diplomat Narvaez responds, none of CNN's speculations reveals that Assange received materials, much less potentially hacked materials. The use of the word potentially shows that CNN is not even sure which materials Assange would have received at the embassy, and there is not even evidence that he received any publication materials at all. It is lengthy, and it's quite enlightening. I encourage you to take a look. There's a link in the show file for this podcast. Also, over at the Washington Post, which occasionally stumbles on some good analysis, Philip Rucker talks about Trump's frustration and the reason he has been trying to divide the Jewish community and raising questions about the loyalty of American Jews who would dare to vote for a Democrat. Well, Rucker writes that Trump decided long ago it would be smart politics for him to yoke his administration to Israel and try to brand the Democratic Party as anti-Semitic. Trump has become flummoxed that Jewish Americans are not lining up to support his reelection after everything that he's done for Israel. And he quotes several people here. Oh, first this statement. The president's rhetoric about Jews magnifies his transactional approach to politics and his miscalculation that his hawkish interpretation of support for Israel should automatically translate into electoral support from Jewish Americans. Then he quotes Jeremy Benami, who I've interviewed before. He's the president of J Street, which they call a liberal pro-Israel advocacy group. It's really a moderate Zionist group in comparison to AIPAC. Nonetheless, Ben Ami says, Trump is reflecting a concept of Jewish Americans as single-issue voters around Israel, which we're not, that we're uniformly hawkish on these issues, which we're not. Back to the voice of Philip Rucker. Trump is thrusting Israel into the culture wars he's raised as president, trying to make support for Israel a litmus test, and calling Democrats anti-Semitic to fire up his base. And as other analysts have pointed out, Trump doesn't expect to peel off that many Jews. He believes that this is going to excite his mostly Christian electoral base. And here's a quote from Dan Shapiro, who was Obama's ambassador to Israel. He calls Trump's expectation of Jewish people voting for him breathtakingly cynical. And he goes on, in his typical buffoonish way, he thinks that by pushing out these instructions essentially to American Jews to get in line and become his supporters, that he's going to be successful. It's all shaped by his narcissism, by his transactional nature. It's all shaped by his insatiable need for praise and confirmation of his greatness, an appreciation for the gifts he's bestowed on whoever it is he's courting. And that's in line with the way he figures that all African Americans should support him because unemployment among blacks is at an all-time low in this country, as if that's the only thing that matters. Also, I want to recommend what is essentially a book review at Mondo Weiss about a new book written by Jewish intellectuals here in the U.S., 40 of them, called Reclaiming Judaism from Zionism, Stories of Personal Transformation. And let's see, here's a quote from the physician Alice Rothschild. She said, each one has a tale to tell of becoming disenchanted as they confronted the reality of systematic Israeli dispossession of the Palestinians. Each offers searing personal examples of the wild world of Zionist silencing and bullying. So that's worth checking out. And I want to recommend a couple of quick things before I wrap up today. A good story at the New York Times today exposing the Buddhist-majority government of Myanmar and its false promises to the Rohingyas they brutally expelled 2 years ago after burning, pillaging, raping. There are over 700,000 refugees in Bangladesh, the neighboring country, and on a regular basis, the Myanmar officials say, oh, we're ready for them to return. But you know what? As of today, only 39 people out of those 31 people out of the nearly 750,000 who left Myanmar have returned of their own volition. Also want to recommend Max Blumenthal's video report from Managua, Nicaragua, where he takes a look at the 40th anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution. I think there's a lot of interesting comment there. Also at the Washington Post today, an in-depth investigation or analysis, I guess, of the struggle inside the company Palantir, which was started with seed money from the CIA's InQtel Venture Capital Fund. It's run by Peter Thiel. The gay man, who is a prominent supporter of Trump, gave him more than $1 million in 2016, and the payback has been clear. Palantir has contracts with ICE to build databases on the people they want to expel from the country, and also they picked up a contract from the Maven program that was rejected by Google after employees there rebelled. And while there are some principled people who work at Palantir who are uncomfortable and object to the use of their software to detain people or to target drone strikes, the company is standing firm and profiteering greatly from it. I think that's an interesting piece. And finally, I want to recommend an investigation and its report at the Chicago Tribune, dated August 21st, so it was published yesterday, and they did independent testing of cell phone emission of radiation. And you will not be surprised to learn that on the iPhone 7, which is the one I currently have, that multiple tests showed that the device routinely put out more radiation than the government studies show or Apple has admitted to. And it's not only Apple. Let's see, the Samsung Galaxy, it's back here toward the end of the article, it has failed a number of tests where the radiation was much greater than the testing that was reported by the company to the Federal Communications Commission. Now, this is on the current generation of phones up to and including 4G. It doesn't include any tests of the 5G system, which is being rolled out despite the objections of many people who are concerned about the increased power of the radiation from the ubiquitous cell towers that will be required to make 5G function. Hey, thanks for listening to my daily news and comment. You're free to share it far and wide. You'll find it on YouTube. And I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.